Welcome, everybody, to this distinguished lecture that's being hosted by the Computer Information Science and Engineering, or SIES, Directorate at NSF. My name is Rance Cleveland, and I'm the Division Director for Computing and Communication Foundations within NSF. It's my great pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Professor Avi Vigdorsson, from the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. Professor Vigdorsson holds the Herbert H. Moss Chair of in the School of Mathematics at the Institute for Advanced Study, where he's been for the past 20 years. He received his PhD from Princeton University, and then spent time at Berkeley and the Hebrew University in Israel, before coming to IAS, where he is currently located. It's fair to say that he's one of the foremost researchers in the world in complexity theory, which is a part of theoretical computer science devoted to the analysis of how computationally expensive different problems are to solve. He's done exemplary and even seminal work in almost every aspect of complexity theory. Many of us remember when having a feeling of achievement in our field, where we tend to have papers that are co-authored with one or two other people. We feel a sense of achievement when we have 100 papers. Well, Professor Vigdorsson has over 100 co-authors. And this is, when I read this, I was astonished at that. It's a testament both to his productivity, but also to the fact that people like working with him, and that's much to be admired. He's won pretty much every prize you can win in the theoretical computer science community for his research. Most recently, along with his longtime collaborator, Laszlo Lobach, he was a winner of the 2021 Abel Prize for Mathematics, often called the Nobel Prize for Math, because it's awarded every year and is managed by the Norwegian Academy of Science and Letters, and indeed funded by the Norwegian Parliament. So kudos to the Norwegian Parliament for recognizing the value of scientific achievement in mathematics. And it's a double congratulations to Avi and his colleague for winning this prestigious award. I will say, I know you're not here to listen to me, you're here to listen to the speaker, and I'll turn the floor over to him in a second, but I will say that as someone who's been in the computer science community for over 30 years myself, this award that was given to our speaker and Professor Lobach is a gratifying recognition that computer science and mathematics and other fields of science and engineering are beginning to bleed into each other, that the old silos in which you either that force you either to do math or do computing are breaking down, and you can now do math and computing. And Avi and his colleagues have much to do with this very important development. So I'll turn the floor over to our speaker. Before I do that, though, let me just remind people that if you have questions, please put them in the chat, and we'll address questions at the end of the talk after Avi's finished. So, Avi, since I know that's what you like to be called, welcome, and I'll turn the floor over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here. I want to tell you today about imitation games. So this is a framework. Actually, there is some noise, which I, just a second. I'm sorry about that. Just, I don't know what to do about it. Okay, we'll have to live with it. As a framework for understanding lots of important notions and what they bring to us. So the plan of the talk is simple. I will start from the original imitation game, this of which Turing defined in order to understand the notion of intelligence. And you'll see the main idea, the paradigm, and I'll talk about some generalizations and maybe speculations, but the body of the talk will be mainly about the modern imitation games, those that are rigorous, which we do in theoretical computer science. And I'll talk about four fields. And you'll see in each of them this paradigm embedded, cryptography, randomness, problems in discrete mathematics, and at the end, privacy. These are all huge fields, but I just have 10 minutes for each. And I want to stress how imitation games, this concept, helps to define central notions in this field and what the consequences are. And yeah, then we'll conclude. So let me start. I'm going to talk about Turing's work, and I have to say a few words about this amazing thinker, of the great thinkers of modern times. You probably know, some of you, what he did. When he was a graduate student in 1936, he wrote a paper that changed our lives, and he ignited both the science of computing as well as the praxis of computing by defining formally what an algorithm is. During World War II, he was a major player in breaking the Enigma machine and helped shortening World War II, basically. He was interested in biological modeling, if you know, but one of his papers on morphogenesis is one of the most quoted papers in biology. And what I want to focus here on is his work on artificial intelligence. So let me tell you about this. He was interested in understanding when is a machine or a program are intelligent. And he wrote this very influential paper in 1950 called Computing Machinery and Intelligence. I really think that everybody should read these papers. I mean, they are so eloquent, so clear. And here's how he starts this paper. He says, I want to understand the question, can machines think? How do I do that? So one way is I can just try to define what is a machine, what is think, and more or less take the ontological approach of what is the nature of these objects or notions. But then you'll start arguing with me about the definitions, and we will not get anywhere. Another approach is what you might say behavioral approach. It's just let's test whether a machine can think. Okay, so that's what he proposes. And let's see his test. That's the famous Turing test, the original imitation game. So somebody claims that a robot or a program are intelligent, and you want to know whether you believe it or not. So you set up this experiment in which there are two different worlds, left and the right. And the question is whether they are distinguishable. We see this picture again and again, these two worlds that we are comparing. In one of them is a program we want to test, in the other is a human. We want to see whether it behaves like a human in some sense. And there is a referee, there is a test. And the tester doesn't know which world he's in, left or right. He's allowed to communicate with this object and ask questions maybe and get answers. And after a while, decide, maybe, can say, that it interacts with the human, or maybe also here with the human, in which case maybe the robot passed the test. Of course, we would like to have a definition of the source that the robot is intelligent if the referee makes similar guesses in both situations, does not distinguish between them. That was a good case. Maybe, you know, in another interaction, it will say the other side is a robot, in which case we'll say the robot didn't pass. I mean, we have a distinction. Of course, there'll be many interactions like this, and decisions don't have to be binary, you know, it's a human or a robot. Maybe you want to give some confidence level or statistical, observation. You want to say it, you know, maybe this looks, you know, I my trust is that it's 92% of a person. And if the two numbers the referee assigns in both worlds are very close to each other, then we want to say that, you know, it passed the test. Needless to say, we will expose this robot or program to many such interactions, maybe with different referees in human, in Turing's case, human referees. They may assign different values than other referees, but as long as they are close, we want to say that the robot passed the test. So generally, we have all these potential referees, and we call a robot, let's say, intelligent, if for every human referee, the confidence or the fraction of, its vote about how human this is, are very close. These are numbers, P0 and P1, are numbers between 0 and 1. If they are very close and we say, yes, the program succeeds, and otherwise not. Maybe you want to replace intelligent by some other notion, you know, being able to, communicate like a human, whatever you like. But anyway, that's the whole point, is here the similarity of the behavior of all possible referees in these two possible worlds, the sort of ideal one or the one you compare to, and the one you are testing. How similar is, of course, I will not get into this, how confident you want to be or what is the gap that you want to say it failed the test. These are practical issues, but we are just going to say very close is use this throughout the talk. Of course, mathematically, you want to define that. So that's the setup. That's how you test whether someone has a property. Of course, you can go beyond intelligence. There are really many important and interesting notions that we like to study. For example, you can ask about computers. In fact, it's being discussed all the time because of the advances of AI. Can a computer feel, emotions, empathy, fear, pain? Can it be conscious, self-aware, and so on? And of course, these questions are, you can ask them about the computer, you can in fact ask them about me, especially on Zoom, but you can ask them about my dog. The point is, the great question, at least Turing's view, is that what we are really testing is whether, in this case, the computer can behave in a way that it feels like they have these feelings or cognition and so on. And so, the behavior is what defines that the property. So you contrast here two, as in Turing's paper, two different approaches to understanding these things. One is the objective or ontological way, which is just give a definition to what does it mean, feeling pain or intelligence, so on. And these problem with these are that often they are not testable, they are not falsifiable, they do not have a universal meaning to everybody. And the other, which Turing advocates, is the subjective behavioral definition. And the main point is that often this can be made precise, testable, operational, and useful. And in fact, as we'll see, revolutionary. So what we are going to do is now move to the modern imitation games and see how similar imitation games Turing tests apply to different, in different fields and different notions formally can create wonders. So let me start. we'll see four examples, as I said, in the in this cryptography, randomness, discrete mass, and privacy. The paradigm is that two things are the same if they cannot be told apart by any reasonable test. That's the paradigm. And of course, reasonable tests will have to, you know, be relevant to the setting we are in and to the notion we are testing. We'll see that we can make, in these cases, formal definitions of very important notions, not intelligence, but other ones. And once this definition will be the primary object, once we have a definition, we'll see that from it follow theorems, proofs, constructions, theories, and applications. I mean, this imitation game paradigm, it's so embedded in our culture and our methodology as a theoretical computer scientist that you know, it's rarely talked about because it's so obvious it should be used, and you see how it is used in you know, to impact math, science, technology, policy, and more in all these examples. And of course, there are many more. I just selected four. Okay, let's start with cryptography. First, let me say about the, you know, talk about the most basic question of cryptography, which is encryption. And it really describes the most activity in cryptography in the first, you know, two or maybe three millennia. Okay, yeah. So here's an example. We want to hide some message. The message is whether to attack or to retreat. And we encode it in some, you know, in some way so that it looks like gibberish to anybody who sees it. That's a thing that encryption is supposed to perform, to hide the information in the real message. Of course, the question, what is the encryption function? You know, history has many examples. 2000 years ago, there was a Caesar cipher in which was just simple substitution of different letters of the alphabet. And this is in fact what I used in this example. I really used Caesar's cipher to encode, encrypt a text and retreat. There are many much more sophisticated substitution codes like the Enigma machine, which was far harder to break. Caesar's is really trivial to break, and in which the substitution depends on time and other parameters. So how do we know if an encryption method is secure, cannot be broken? In fact, what does it mean? How do we define that an encryption method is secure? Here is how we define it. I mean, it took this 2000 years, but you know, like almost 40 years ago, again, graduate students, God bless her, Nikali, gave us a definition of security in the same vein as Turing. It says the following. We want to say that encryption method is secure if you cannot distinguish the encryption of any two messages. So here on the left, we have an encryption of one particular message, M0, and the right, we have an encryption of M1. And what does it mean it cannot be told apart? By whom? What is a reasonable test? Well, let's allow any algorithm, any program that tries to decipher it, decide whether it's on the left or the right, and say a confidence. You know, it believes in its M0 or M1. If every algorithm given access to any of these behaves the same way, then we say, no, there is nothing about the messages that reveal their content. Nobody can get even a hint of whether it's in the left or on the right, or whether the attack or retreat are encrypted there. So then we say that the encoding, the encryption method is secure. This means that, I mean, if you consider it, it's a very strong definition. It's more or less shooting for the moon. I think that you ask this to be true for any two messages, which means that even if the whole vocabulary is attack or retreat, you cannot distinguish between them, which already tells you a lot. Let me say something about this definition, which is so strong. It means that in particular, no deterministic scheme, in particular this substitution cipher, are secure under this definition. Okay, and it's a really a formal mathematical definition of secrecy, of what is a secret, something that is encrypted by such an encryption scheme. And so the main question is, you know, very good, we have a definition, is it possible to achieve it by any means? And of course, the answer is yes. One can achieve such ultimate security based on simple mathematical hardness assumptions. You all know that, these methods are based usually on mathematical assumptions like that factoring integers are hard, in the sense that you can achieve the security if anybody broke any such system, they will be able to factor integers, a problem that resisted attack for, 200 years or maybe a millennium. And once this happened, once this definition was in place, we were able to do theory of cryptography. This is a mathematical definition. You can prove security in the sense that you can relate it to the very simple complexity assumption underlying it, one-way function, trapdoor function, etc. And then you can use it to do other things. Once this was in place, cryptography, that the aspirations of cryptography changed completely, and they became being able to do much more than just encryption. And you all live with it: online shopping, contract signing, secret message exchange, zero knowledge proofs, elections on the internet, playing poker without cards, blockchains, digital currency, and many more applications that I'm sure many of you know about. But they all happen without any physical implements. They happen digitally between many players. Some of them will be bad, malicious, and so on. So for all of these, we have protocols describing what actors in these various games should do. And the question is, how do you define protocol security? This is a far more challenging problem than defining the security of encryption, because there you just encrypt the message and send. It's a one-time act. Protocol is maybe a really complicated thing in which many players send many messages and so on. And so let me give you an example to what is secure. I will focus on internet elections, but this you'll see the spirit of this is relevant to all others. Again, it will be a definition. The definition of protocol security for elections, say, will be an imitation game. You want to compare an ideal situation. Ideal may not be ideal. I'm using ideal as what you hope, or I mean ideal or what exists. What exists is a world on the left, where the way we vote is we basically give our vote, maybe in envelopes, to some central trusted entity like the government. Then they tally it up and tell us the results. That's what you would like to happen, but suppose you want to do it in a distributed fashion, you don't trust anybody. So you are on the right and you design a protocol. How would you say that the protocol is secure? It performs what it should? Well, you want to say it just is indistinguishable from the ideal one, from the one on the left. Simply, what does it mean? For example, no player is supposed to learn from this interaction more than it would learn on the right, more than it would learn on the left, even though there may be more communication that is exposed to. Another way of saying it is that if any algorithm is trying to extract information from what the player has seen, it will not be able to do that on the left or on the right. And of course, it's not what for, so that would be the definition. So we want to say it's secure if for every efficient algorithm and every player, the output of any such algorithm will be similar. And so it happens also for players that may misbehave. Maybe they are trying to, it's not just about information you gain. You want to say that no one can influence the election. Nobody can vote twice, for example, or disrupt other people's votes and so on. So you want all these properties to happen in this distributed setting, and you want it not just for individual players. You also want that a coalition of players cannot learn more than it should, you know, in the ideal case. So it's really about every subset of players. So it's a very strong definition again. And as described in these papers above, this can be achieved again under the same assumptions. In fact, the same assumptions that are enough for secure encryption are enough to achieve protocol security for practically any cryptographic task. I'm not going into this, it's quite complicated, but I just wanted to stress that the definition we shoot for this is this very general definition. You cannot distinguish the actual thing, the digital protocol, from an ideal situation where there is a trusted party. Of course, you know, with this in place, I mean, this is basically how the theory of cryptography developed and how it was implemented, and we all live with the fruits of it in internet security, shopping, and et cetera, et cetera. You all, this is part of everybody's life today. So that's about cryptography. Let me move now to the second topic, which is randomness. And randomness, again, something that's, I guess it's a topic dear to me. I invested many years in trying to understand randomness, but it's, I think, dear to almost everyone. It's very easy to talk about randomness with practically anyone. Everyone has some feeling or ideas about luck, about chance, about how this affects their lives. Of course, scientists and mathematicians and statisticians and physicists have looked at the various notions of randomness. So it's a well-studied concept. And what I want to tell you is the theoretical computer science take on this and how we view it and how we view the lens, use the lens of imitation game on it and what it gives us. We know randomness is extremely powerful. So first, let me say, you know, nature seems to supply us with perfect randomness, at least it seems in our analysis. So let me denote these golden coins as unbiased independent bits. We assume we have access to perfect randomness. And then once you assume it, there are numerous applications. We use it in sampling, in scientific experiments, in probabilistic algorithms, cryptography, game theory, gambling, all sorts of applications. I want to highlight probabilistic algorithms because, first of all, they capture many of the others. It's just algorithms or programs that use randomness. And it seems that these are extremely powerful. They seem to solve problems much faster in many cases than deterministic ones. And the question I want to ask here is, whether this power is real, is randomness really much more powerful than determinism? And it's a critical question because we have to think about where is the randomness, you know, nature seemed to provide us this, but you know, do we really have it? So let me confront three different possible worlds in which we live in. One is, on the left I have, three different possibilities for the universe. One is that it really has perfect randomness, that we can really tap independent, unbiased coins as many as we want. This is the world we theorists live in when we design probabilistic algorithms. And in this case, we get all the applications I mentioned in the previous slide. But what really seems to happen is that we are, at least we are experiencing is lots of events or phenomena in the world that we tap into seem to have some randomness or some entropy in them. You can think about sunspots, maybe stock market behavior, weather, quantum phenomena. We can sample them and get from them coin tosses, but they look in this my picture antique, kind of maybe they are not independent, maybe they are biased and so on. And so the question is, how can we use them? I mean, in this all application or in algorithms. It's pretty clear that just using them as they are doesn't give anything. So we want to model them and then say whether they're useful. If you have an algorithm that runs under perfect randomness, what do you do if all you have is this weak random source? And the third possible world is a world in which there is no randomness. Everything is deterministic. What can you do? I mean, what do you do with a probabilistic algorithm if really, everything you are sampling is there is no distribution, it's determined. So I want to explain how to answer what we know about the answers to these questions. But first I need to make a definition that's absolutely crucial, is what does it mean for a distribution to look random? So what we would like is a definition that will make a probability distribution, which is maybe not perfect, look random. And again, we set up an imitation game for that. On the left, we have the ideal world in which we have perfect randomness. On the right, we have some distribution on, let's say, on bits. And we want to call it pseudo-random. It looks like random if, again, every algorithm, every possible test that you, that might use it, every algorithm that runs using these bits will behave in the same way, whether it's on the left and on the right. So, very natural, in fact. Again, it's a mathematical definition. This is something that you define formally. And again, the question is whether we can have it. I mean, are the distributions that are far from uniform that can have such a property is not obvious at all. And how to build them, how to construct them. I'll just say, I'm not going to go into this, but this definition affords, like the previous ones, composition of algorithms of strengthening amplification of error, for example. In general, the fact that we are testing them with efficient algorithms, these distributions, has come to be called the hardness versus randomness paradigm, which you'll see soon. And they lead to the ability of generating such pseudo-random distributions and using them in these applications. And of course, like before, we get practical applications as well. In pseudo-random generation, in cryptography, it's extremely important. But what I wanted to tell you about the punchline, this has been under study for several decades. And by now we have beautiful theories explaining the two different worlds we talked about. So let's see what they are. So perfect randomness, we get all these wonderful applications. It turns out that we, summarizing, we don't lose much in these other worlds. So if we have only a little entropy in our sources, just a little entropy, it turns out that we don't lose anything. We can simulate all probabilistic algorithms with sources that may be bias dependent, but just have some entropy in them. This is the content of what may be called extractor theory. Extractor means the extraction or the purification of randomness. So it's methods in which you take distributions that are not really good, just have some randomness in them somewhere, and purifying them, extracting from them maybe fewer, but enough perfect random bits, and then you can use the probabilistic algorithm. So you lose nothing in this sort of much more realistic scenarios where your sources of randomness are pretty weak. What about the world in which there's no randomness at all? The world is deterministic. How do you run a probabilistic algorithm in a deterministic world? Well, here you need an assumption, but an assumption that almost comes from for free. We are going to assume that P is different than NP. This is a jargon. That's the main conjecture of theoretical computer science, major conjecture in mathematics, which I'm not going to explain exactly, but the assumption really is that some computational problems are difficult to solve. this is an assumption that everybody is comfortable with. It seems that there are many, in fact, too many problems we'd like to solve that we cannot. And that's all we need to assume. If you assume that, then we get, again, that we can simulate all probabilistic algorithms, in this case, deterministically, in fact, without error. This is the content of this paradigm, hardness versus randomness. We start from an assumption about computational difficulty, and we use it to build pseudo-random generators which fool all algorithms. And one way to summarize the result is that every fast probabilistic algorithm in existence, and also those that were not invented yet, can be replaced by a deterministic one without loss in much loss in time, and as I said, become errorless. So this all comes from understanding the definition of pseudo-randomness, and of course, much, much more work. Okay, so this was the end of the second part. I want to stress that from this theory, and it's so about cryptography too, there are unexpected benefits that have nothing to do with randomness. For example, there's a huge influence from extractor theory to network design. And there are many others. I just make it as a side note that the theory happens to help other fields as well. I want to move now to structural pseudo-randomness. This is the discrete mathematical part. This, these four topics I'm talking about, some may speak to you and some may speak to you less. This will be different than the others. And it's pretty fascinating. So let me tell you about this. Let me start with what's called Ramsey's theorem at a high level, says the following surprising statement. Every large enough system must have some structure, some subsystem which is extremely structural. I'll give you examples, but it's a very strong statement. And here is one example. So periodicity. Periodicity is structure. Here I listed all the integers. I mean, I listed them up to 40, but you can continue it in your imagination, all the integers. And here are some periodic sequences in the integers. The top one has every fourth one, 7, 11, 15, 19, etc. And the bottom one, I pick every seventh, like 9, 16, 23, and so on. So of course, the integers possess many periodic sequences. That's a no-brainer. But suppose I gave you just a subset of the integers, some sparse subset of the integers, and I ask, does it contain periodic sequences? Of course, in this particular set of integers I gave you, neither of them exist. But you can ask, maybe there are others that are periodic sequences. Maybe, do we have long periodic sequences? Two is obvious, but anything bigger than two, are there three terms that are aligned such a periodic sequence in an arithmetic progression? So which subsets contain long periodic sequences? Long, you can think of 1,000 or 1,000,000. And Semeredi, in an extremely famous and important paper, proved that all dense subsets do. So all dense subsets of integers, if you have 1% of all integers, there must be periodic sequences of every length, 1,000,000, billion, whatever you like. And not just 1%, even if you take 1,000,000th of all integers, it will still contain it. So that's pretty amazing. And then you start yourself, what if I take maybe even sparser set? Maybe I take just this set of integers, which is of course very familiar, it's just a set of primes. Do the primes contain periodic sequences? They get sparser and sparser. It looks unlikely, but the famous Green-Tau theorem from 15 years ago shows that they do. So what's going on, and how can you prove something like this? Here is an easy observation. If the set of integers that you are interested in was picked at random, then it would not be difficult to show that periodic sequences exist. That would be easy. So here's the amazing, attack by Semeradi on this problem. We want to understand which subset look random. If they look random, then they'll have the property that random ones do. And he first changes the focus to not look at subsets of integers, but look at networks, which is also independently interesting. And he shows that every dense network looks random. So I want to explain this because it's fundamental and of practical value. So in order to explain in what sense networks look random, I want to talk about what networks are, what clusters are, and what bonds between clusters are. Here's a network. You can think of a network of roads, network of the internet, maybe network of friends in Facebook. A cluster is just a community, a subset of these nodes in the network. And a bond, you take two communities and look, count the number of connections between them, okay? And P will be the bond between them. It's a fraction of edges between them, connections between them relative to the total maximal number they could have. Okay, so it can be 1% or 100%, or maybe there are no connections between. Okay, so that's a bond between two communities. Now, having the notion of a bond, I can define bond similarity of two networks. And again, we have an imitation game. We have on the left, on the right, two networks, N1 and N2. And we want to say that they are bond similar. When I say bond similar, if every two communities on the left and on the right will have the same bond. So we may look at these guys and look at the bond and these same two communities here, the number of the fraction of connections is very similar. And similarly here, and you can imagine looking at all possible pairs of subsets and comparing, and if these numbers are close in all cases, we say that they are bond similar. So now we have a definition through an imitation game. We have a definition of similarity between networks. And now we want to be able to define in what sense every network looks random. This is a regularity lemma of Semeradi. Here we have an arbitrary network. And what Semeradi says is that every network is bond similar, is basically indistinguishable from a random network. And I have to explain in what sense random. So what he will argue is that every network can be summarized by a tiny model that defines this random object. So bonds between few communities in this original network N0 will determine all possible bonds. It's sort of hard to believe statement. So let me explain it. He shows how to cleverly choose communities. In this case, I chose three communities. They are disjoint, red one, green one, and blue one. Okay. And let's just look at the bond between every pair, the reds within the reds to the blues, the reds to the greens, the blues to the greens, and so on. And we have this little table. And this already defines a random model that can create another network, what network. We put the same communities down. And now we use these numbers in order to randomly pick connections according to these probabilities. We pick, with probability 0.8 between every pair of red vertices, with probability 0.3, like on the diagonal, right? So that's, these numbers determined with probability 0.2 among the greens, and then with probability 0.1 between reds and blues. We create this random network according to the model. And what Semeradi's theorem says, or the regularity lemma, is that every bond on the right will, with very high probability, every bond on the right will be the same as the bond on the left, even though we prescribed only, three communities. This is an amazing theorem. It has an amazing proof that, of course, I will not see, and the amazing consequences. One of them is this theorem about progressions or periodic sequences in integers. But in fact, it goes well beyond networks and integers. So we already saw dense graphs, dense sequences look random in a very specific way. But this turns out to be true for other objects, many other objects, functions and tables and so on. And in fact, I talked about bond similarity, but there are other tests. And in fact, an arbitrary set of tests you can apply to test whether two objects like these are similar. So there's a whole theory there. And it developed separately in the mathematics world as a transference principle, and the theoretical computer science world as a dense model theorem. But basically, its understanding is an amazingly powerful tool in mathematics. It sometimes goes by the name structure versus randomness dichotomy. And it has seen applications in many, many areas of mathematics and computer science so far, and probably just the beginning. So it's an amazing, powerful tool that comes from a way of, again, from an indistinguishability notion, from a notion that is captured by an imitation game. Okay, that was the end of the third part, and let me go to the last one, which is privacy, the last 10 minutes. So I'm changing gears a lot, and you can recuperate after each one. This is an amazingly important notion again, and that everybody cares about the privacy of their, whatever information they want to keep private from others. And of course, privacy, you can keep everything private and then, nobody else will be able to use it and maybe use it in ways that are beneficial to you. So there's really a trade-off between privacy and utility, and I want to explain this trade-off or two aspects of data. So imagine we have a database, say, in which there are many individual records about us, for example. It can be census data, it can be medical data. Once you have data, of course, there are data analysts, there are people and entities who want to use this data. And of course, generally use it for a public good. They want to understand it and make inferences that will help us. So that's the utility part. If it's census data, maybe it teaches us about welfare gaps, about urban planning, about design of roads and so on. If it's medical data, of course, it's really important to understand it in order to do better drug development and treatments and understanding of diseases and pandemics and so on. So of course, data needs to be used. On the other hand, the privacy side says, look here, maybe there's some participant, Jane Doe, do I want to be in this database? Maybe the information that is in the record is private to me. Should I participate if it's maybe a medical study or maybe it's a census, or should I tell the truth and so on? What protects me against data analysts or their discoveries that may be later used to, as often happens, you read in the press, reveal the information of public individuals? And of course, this is an old problem. Existed for decades. And there are many solutions. You can restrict the queries, you can do statistical ones, like you want to say you are only allowed to ask for the average salary of people between 30 and 60 who live in the West Coast or something like this. So that's another one, is to filter the answers, to noisify them in some way, to apply noise before you don't give the accurate answers, but with some noise. And of course, there are many suggestions, and many of them implemented, and some of them good. The main problem, I would say, is that there was no theory. There was no theory. There was no way to actually argue mathematically precisely about what can leak and what amount, and any guarantees. So this changed dramatically 15 years ago in this amazing paper. which define the notion of differential privacy. So I want to explain it. And again, it's just an imitation game. What does Jane Doe care about? She cares about that her information will not be leaked, but what can capture it? So we want to capture when is a filtering mechanism will be protective of her, will be differentially private. But we want to say that basically the data analysis, the queries asked cannot reveal, cannot differentiate between her presence in the database and her absence. Okay, so if a query is applied to the database on the left and the database on the right, in which the only difference is the presence or absence of a particular individual, it will give essentially the same answer. So here's the definition. A filter is differentially private. Again, as we saw in all other examples, if every adjacent databases, D0 and D1, they differ only in one record, and every legal query, of course, we have to choose our set of tests, the behavior is the same. So this is a definition again. And again, like in all previous definitions, it's, you know, it's mathematical and it allows the building of a theory. And the properties, again, like before, it once you have a definition like this, it automatically allows you to do many things. Once you know how much information or how private one query is, you can talk about many queries, how information aggregates, you can do composition of mechanisms, you can trade off accuracy for the number of queries. This definition has an extra feature, which is extremely important, that it resists also future knowledge. If Jane Doe later puts in our website some other information, you probably know that many databases were sort of broken into because of comparing them to information external and allowing to extract to the combination to extract information about individuals. This, by definition, says that future information or knowledge or other databases will not create this problem. And this theory is not just a theory, and it has really pretty amazing ingenious algorithms in which you are able to allow many more than you think queries and of more general types and make them private. But it also proved itself on the ground. I mean, it's very young, but still it is used by, it was the major decision by the government to use, to release information of the 2020 census using differentially private mechanisms to analysts. And all the big companies like Google, Amazon, Facebook, and many others that, as you know, hold enormous amounts of information about us and about our habits, do release data for study, which is important. And they claim that in many cases, they use differentially private mechanisms to do this. So it really had amazing success in a short time being implemented and used. But what I want to talk about in my last slide is, again, a surprising, unpredictable consequence of this theory, which has nothing to do with privacy. And let me end with this story. So this is in these two amazing papers, again, following the original one. It has to do with the adaptive data analysis. So we talked about data and data analysts or scientists or machine learning people that are trying to understand collection of data and learn from its theories about the world or about medicine or about whatever. How does it work? I mean, it's a well-known process that we've been doing as for years, right? We have this data, and we ask some queries, and we get some answers, and then We tune the parameters and maybe form new hypotheses and think about what other queries we want to ask. And then we ask them and we get more answers and so on. And this cycle goes on, and that's how we make progress as a society. And you look at this, say, okay, what's wrong? I mean, we have made lots of sciences, lots of progress. We did develop, cures for various diseases and how to improve our lives in various ways, how to invent various products and so on. So what's wrong with this? Well, I'm sure, again, many of you know that there's a whole discussion in the past, suddenly the last decade, it blew up about the crisis in science. Here's the title of an article that had at least 10,000 or 20,000, citations. Why most published research findings are wrong. So it's pretty bad, right? Most published research findings are wrong. That's something that you should worry about if it's true, and many people feel that it's true. So what's wrong with this process I just described? How can it be wrong? Well, in fact, it's pretty obvious what's wrong and in the way science works. In fact, there are several, but I want to focus on one. First, you have to realize that data is expensive. So, it's hard to get. So this causes the reuse of data. So data is reused in this process that this cycle that I described. And data reuse causes overfitting. The analysis tends to understand and explain the data better and better in the modeling it uses. And the negative effect is that it's less good in generalization. So you have to remember, we don't really want to understand the data well. What do we want to understand? I mean, the data came from somewhere. We want to understand the world. I mean, the data was just sampled from some natural phenomena. Maybe it's a disease, or maybe it's some natural thing, something about nature. Why are bees disappearing, or global warming, or whatever? And it was sampled to create this database, but we really want to understand the process that we sampled from. So here is an amazing thing. So that's a problem. That's a crisis. That's that's basically the summary of why there is a problem. We understand too well the data we have as opposed to the phenomena which data was sampled from. So what to do about this if you cannot get more data, if it's really expensive? Here's something amazing that they observed, the Dwork et al. And these papers. Suppose that you apply a differentially private mechanism filter to the data you have, even though you don't care about privacy. Maybe it's about it's something completely neutral. You don't care about privacy. But nevertheless, you noisify the data, the answers to the queries in appropriate ways, like in differential privacy, and just let this process run. And it turns out that you can prove that under this change, data reuse and it does not have these faults. It prevents overfitting. It ensures statistical validity and the ability to generalize. And this is despite the reuse and the adaptivity. So it's an amazingly beautiful theorem. It's a very surprising consequence of this notion that has nothing to do with privacy. And I think it will impact the way scientific experiments are handled. Okay, let me summarize, just about on time. Here's the paradigm that I advocated, or Turing advocated, from the beginning. It's that things are identical unless you can tell them apart. It can be anything. I mean, we talked about various notions, but can apply to whether diamonds are fakes or real, or Picasso's are, or news are real or fake. And the stress is you. You may be, it's basically all the tests, that's a subjective part in the definition, all the tests that you have at your disposal that are reasonable. I mean, if you everything you test with doesn't distinguish, you know, particular fake diamond from a real one, then, you know, you might as well call it real. That's the message. Such behavioral subjective definitions that appear in all these imitation games are extremely powerful, and we've seen consequences of them to important theories that have amazing applications which impact our lives. And they may be useful, as I said in the beginning of the talk, to study other notions, both philosophical or, you know, maybe more cognitive in nature. It's essentially, many other notions in a similar way, and hopefully in a more precise way than, let's say, the understanding of intelligence in the beginning. And this should lead to, you know, much more, hopefully, theories and applications. I didn't discuss other settings in which we have already similar ones. Maybe I should mention the beautiful emerging science of fairness in algorithms and fairness in general that start from a similar starting point of an imitation game or several imitation games. To summarize, I would say that it stresses how much the theory of computation is a modeling science. It's not just building theories that have lots of theorems in them and you know, design principles and so on. They often start from finding the right definition. And of course, being computer scientists make essential tuning to whatever process we are trying to understand, whatever the resources it is using. And this is all implicit in the definitions I told you, even though I didn't specify them. And these definitions are primary. Once you have them, as I mentioned, these have these consequences in math, science, technology, policy, and so on. So let me conclude with the bookend for something I wrote, completed 2 years ago. You can buy it if you like the cover design, but really it's free on my website. In it, you can see much more details about the first three topics I talked about. I didn't talk about here in about privacy, but on the other hand, I talk about other things. And of course, not just about imitation games, but in general about complexity theory and the theory of computation and its interaction with mathematics and with the sciences. Thank you.
Great, thank you very much. I wish there were a way we could all applaud all of us applaud at the same time. Those of you who can, please clap your hands using the reaction button. And otherwise, we can move to questions, of which a few have appeared on the Q&A button. If you to the audience, if you do have a question you'd like to pose, please use the Q&A feature. And what I'll do is I'll read through them, and the speaker can respond to them. So the first question comes from somebody anonymous, and the question is, and this is in reference, I think, to the first two parts of your talk, where you mentioned efficient algorithms as being the judges for whether the mechanisms are indeed, I guess in that case, they were distinguishable. So the question is, how do you know if you have access to every efficient algorithm? And I think what the question is probably asking is, how do you quantify over the set of all, how do you know when you've quantified over the set of all the efficient algorithms and those examples you gave?
Yeah, so I don't need to know. You ask how do you, yeah, okay. So it's a very good question, because this is in a sense exactly why this definition is extremely strong. It says that regardless which efficient algorithm or which efficient test you apply to the encryptions or to the distribution, so on, regardless of that, you'll get a similar answer. So if you can achieve it, the first point is that if you can achieve it, it's something extremely strong. It's really indistinguishable. How do you prove, once you have this definition, how do you prove that a particular construction, let's say of an encryption scheme or a pseudo-random generator passes this test? This is a whole new ball game, and I didn't talk about this, but basically it's using implicitly computationally hard functions, and computationally hard are those that cannot be solved by any efficient algorithm. That's just a definition of being computationally hard. How do you turn a computationally hard problem into something that looks random or into an encryption scheme? This needs ideas and works and proofs and so on. And subject to a different talk.
Great, thanks. Let's see, we have another question. This person is referring to the last part of the talk where you had the differential privacy and its use in determining fighting against data overfitting. So in your last example, there is a close connection between privacy and robustness. So in the imitation game, do we generally smooth or remove features from the distribution applied to the protocol to achieve indistinguishability from the ideal case?
Yeah, so it's here the indistinguishability is not from an ideal case. So unlike cryptography, for example, but rather indistinguishability between the situation that you ran is in the database, whereas you are not in the database. We want that the two databases, one with you and one without you, will be indistinguishable. And the smoothing mechanisms that are applied is the noise mechanism that somehow perturb the answers to the queries is supposed to, on the one hand, be close enough so that the data will be valuable, and far enough so that your presence or absence will not be noticed, and you'll feel that your privacy is preserved. And of course, this trade-off exists, and it controls the type of queries and the number of queries that are asked. But at least you get a formal guarantee that if you ask a million questions of a different particular nature, then it will still be differentially private, and you can rest assured that information about you particularly, or about me particularly, or about any individual or a group of individuals will be revealed. So that's exactly what this definition allows.
Excellent. Next question. How does or might this framework help in addressing the hard problem of consciousness? I guess, can you imagine an imitation game where consciousness is the what you're trying to characterize?
Yeah, I can definitely imagine. In fact, I have. So, it's not my, first of all, I should say, it's not my speciality. I'm an amateur in the field of understanding consciousness or other, cognitive properties, let's say, of machines. I often talk to, neuroscientists or other scientists that are trying to understand consciousness and other such properties, and they tend to make ontological definitions. They tend to make definitions about the nature of consciousness, which I, I can easily start arguing with them. On the one hand, and on the other hand, I talk to many friends and people in general who just say a computer cannot be conscious, or a computer cannot be, cannot fall in love, or something like this. And I try in both cases, I try to relate this, at least point of view that Turing suggests, that what we feel about consciousness, about I think you are conscious, for example, this is just a property of your behavior. There is nothing besides the behavior, the interaction I have with you, that will tell me whatever my definition is. So I would say that to test consciousness or any other property like that, you want to, and you want to say, let's say machines don't have it, or you know, dogs don't have it, or I don't have it. Let's say, you know, whoever is proposing such a definition, let's run a test and run them against, you know, on the one hand, a person, the other hand, a computer, just very similar to the one in intelligence. So this will satisfy one particular scientist, maybe, that their definition is good. What you want, of course, is, you know, if it satisfies all tests, whatever all tests are, maybe tests by humans, although even this should not be the limit. So I think that this point of view, it's not that it's a solution for everything, but I think it's extremely informative when you are forced to think about the behavioral aspects. It also removes some psychological barrier that people often have about, you know, like the statement that computers can't feel, can't love. I say, when you look at the, you know, what do you, why do you say that, you know, a couple is in love? Somebody besides you, you about your own emotions, you can say you just feel that. About somebody else or other entities, then, you know, you should think about subjecting them, you know, what you observe about them is that makes you feel they have this property. And then you should say, why can't some other entity convince you of the same thing by similar behavior? So that's, the behavioral issue aspect is the main message there.
Great. Let's see, next question. I'm gonna jumble up the order a little bit. Well, I'll get to every question though, don't worry for those of you who are asking them. So the question is, do efficient algorithms include quantum algorithms? And I guess by this, I mean, if you allow quantum behavior, does this sort of, what effects does this have on the on this distinguishability the distinguishability of these different settings?
It's a fantastic question, and it's also it's a great demonstration to the malleability of this definition and point of view of imitation gain. So it does change a lot. I mean, of course, we currently seem to believe that quantum algorithms are more powerful than classical ones. We don't know that, of course, but they seem to solve some problems, like in fact, factoring integers, for example, much faster than classical algorithms. So the power of what is you know, what is called efficient changes seems to change when we move to quantum computation. I want to stress that while we have quantum algorithms, we don't have quantum computers yet. And we may never have them. So we don't know that this is really feasible. There's lots of debate and, of course, lots of attempts. Billions of dollars are invested in building a reliable quantum computer. So we don't know that there's no quantum computer yet to factor, to use the algorithm for factoring integers. But, of course, there's a possibility of that. And everybody is bracing themselves to it. And changing security systems to rely not on factoring and not on discrete logarithms, but on other problems that seem to be resistant to even quantum attacks. But the point I want to make is that take the original definition and just plug quantum algorithms instead of classical algorithms, then you have a new definition. And indeed, you want, let's say in cryptography, you want an encryption scheme to be secure if it passes all these tests. And in fact, quantum cryptography is a live and kicking subject, and there are, protocols that, for example, for key exchange, actually from the 80s, that resist quantum attacks. So it's really important to remember that you can play with the power of the tests, of the powers of the algorithms that are used to distinguish in these two different worlds.
Great. Let's see. So I see there, the next question is a little open-ended. So what are some of the limitations of imitation games? And before I turn that over to you, I can't help but noticing that limitation is L-imitation. So L could be a parameter, and then you have imitation games. But
that's
I'll let you.
I'll use this version. Thanks. Yeah, that's really amazing. It's a... it's a very good point. So I would say that you know, you should think of imitation games as one aspect of the methodology that we have in trying to understand the world, trying to understand the power of computation, and trying to model computation. Every idea that we have has, you know, is not applicable everywhere. I would say that you know, it's a very powerful, as I tried to demonstrate, and very general tool, but it, for example, doesn't help you, you know, it helps you define things, and then you not need to prove them. I mean, this, the definition alone does not explain how to build a pseudo-random generator. It aids it a lot in, you know, in being so general and malleable to various aspects like reductions, compositions, and so on. These are used in the proof of theorems about security of systems or pseudorandom generators, or you know, all the other applications. But it's just a part in a methodology that builds models and creates theories about both natural processes and existing computational devices. I think. That's a reasonable summary. I hope it, I'm answering partly the question.
Yes. Let's see. Next question. Do these theories give a hint whether true randomness exists in nature or not?
No, absolutely not. And they are not designed to answer this question. It's not clear quite how would you answer this question. It answers the question of what to do if, you know, we don't have it. I don't know that there is, you know, a test that we can apply to know if there's randomness in the world or not. Of course, there are theories like quantum mechanics, which postulate, really postulate the existence of randomness. I mean, the theory predicts that if you test, you know, a photon, whether the spin or up is up or down, it will be up with probability half and down with probability half. That's a postulation of the, in fact, experiments seem to verify this. Of course, they verify it up to some accuracy, and then we get into the weak randomness sort of thing. They also predict that if you do it twice to two photons, you will get independent answers. Again, you know, observations seem to support this. And again, there are accuracy issues, and of course, measurement issues, and so on. So even if the theory predicts it's perfect, you never get anything perfect, and you have to use the imperfect ones. But it does not answer the question of whether these exist or not. I mean, I think that in general, our life, we have to see what we can get with what we have in a guaranteed fashion. And so it's really important to model situations in which we don't have the perfect ones that we hope to have and how to use them.
Yes, yes. Let's see, one other question just came in. Let me just see, I'm sort of reading it on the fly. There's new work that this person attributes to Jane Lin and Sahai, I don't know what that is, 2020, on indistinguishability obfuscation, which, if I understand it, might make two programs indistinguishable where the computer running them is the test observer.
Yeah.
Is there anything fundamentally different between the data, parentheses, the output, versus the computations in an imitation game?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and it's another example I could have given. It's really part of cryptography. It's a great advance in cryptography. The question, obfuscation is the task of encrypting not a message, but a program. It's okay. A much more difficult task because it's not a syntactic object. It's something that has meaning. A program is computing something. So you just invented a new algorithm, or you have a new chip, you a company or a person, and you want to release it, but you want to own the rights to it, right? So it would be great if you could create a different program that would compute the same function, but nobody can use it. It will look like a random thing. It will not reveal, it cannot be probed and looked in order to understand what it's doing. So the task is that it will, the only information we'll get from this program is its input-output behavior, right? Like it will be a black box, even though you can look at the wiring or the code, it will still look like a black box. For some 25 years, it was attempted in various ways, and people tried to find reasonable definitions. Turns out that factoring is hard, is not enough for this, so nobody knows how to use it. Finding reasonable assumptions, mathematically sound assumptions create this, and Amit Sahai and his colleagues just last year managed to do it. It's an exceptionally complex construction. But in it, the definition of what obfuscation is an imitation game. It's about being unable to distinguish two different obfuscations of the same program. That's another great example of this.
Great. Okay, a couple more questions have come in. Let's see. Is there an imitation game happening between automatic theorem provers / computer assisted mathematics and mathematicians doing their job?
It's a great idea to set one up. I think that it's actually sort of complementary. It's a good example for the question asked before about limitations of imitation games. I think that everybody knows that mathematical theorems, as they appear in mathematical journals, are not exactly proofs in the logical sense of the word, right? They use English, they use abbreviations, they use previous results, they use phrases like it's easy to see or analogous to the other proof, blah, blah. And it's a serious problem. And automatic verification of theorems is important, like automatic verification of systems. And people are developing tools, and these tools have to do with, first of all, formalizing mathematical proofs. So you want to convert loosely formed proof in English to one that is written in some formal language, and then being able to verify it. We see more and more of this, and we see more and more need of this. Many modern theorems are using proofs that are based on computer code, for example, and you'd like to verify that the code is correct. Most famous example is the four-color theorem, of course, that's an old example, but there are many recent ones, like the resolution of the Kepler conjecture by Tom Hales, the fact that there's no better way to pack oranges than the way you see in the market in this regular lattice form. They use computer search, and I don't see an imitation game there. What I see is the ideal is a logical proof, and you want to come close to it, but it's not about distinguishing. I think it's easy to distinguish between human written proofs in a journal and a formal mathematical proof. The problem is arriving at maybe more sound proofs, more error, resilient proofs than ones existing, because every so often there are errors discovered in various mathematical proofs. Yes.
Yeah. I think that's well stated. And as you noted, the difference between a logical proof and a mathematician's proof are they're immediately different objects, and so any imitation game would have to overcome those fundamental differences.
I should mention there's one aspect in the other direction that is goes in favor of mathematical, the way mathematical proofs are stated. There's a lot of stress on intuition and in conveying the ideas that help you bring about the proofs that maybe later be formally written. But what mathematicians learn of proofs is not just the correctness of the statement claim, but actually, you know, how it was resolved. So, yeah.
So we have two more questions, and I think we'll let you have a break to go eat your lunch and have a coffee or something. So let's see, the next question. How much importance should be attached to reproducibility? Does adaptive data reuse complicate reproducibility of results? Are there cases where reproducibility is not necessarily the right goal?
Well, I think it's a very important goal, and that's one way that science is battling, you know, issues that we discuss that are related to this, you know, data reuse or other problems with the scientific experiment. So I don't think that reproducibility is something that should be stopped. I just said that there is a way to use data using these differentially private mechanisms in which the statistical validity of what you find is provably, if you, that's what you do, is provably, generalizable to the, you know, to the, you know, phenomena you are sampling from. So, I would say both are important.
Yes. And the last question, actually, this is a nice one. Do you use any imitation games in your daily life?
Daily life, I think all of us use imitation games in our daily lives. I mean, I think that lots of statements we make about our, things we observe, about what we think of other people and other events are just about the information that we got about them and, you know, not about the objects themselves. I mean, as I tell, some people, you don't really know that I exist, right? I mean, I don't really know that you exist. Everything happens in my brain. I don't know that there's a world out there that I'm actually giving this lecture to. Yeah, it's all in my head. So I think that, that's a lot of this is going on. It's not that we have to consciously evaluate this in any second, but I think that it's good to realize that our interaction with the world is through our senses, and that's the only input we have. So in some sense, we all live in some kind of matrix.
Yes. I would also, just to add to those points, anytime you tell yourself, oh, that's good enough, you're basically playing an imitation game, because good enough means indistinguishable from something that maybe is better sometimes, but according to the ways you have of distinguishing things, good enough is good enough.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I agree completely. That's a very good example of using an imitation. It's all about being good enough.
There you go.
It's relative to whatever your criteria is. Yes.
Yes. Well, this has been a fascinating talk. I will say that there were several statements going through the Q&A, which I didn't read off, talking about how expressing people's fascination with the ideas and appreciation of your presentation. So, and I want to add my personal enthusiastic endorsement of all those statements. So I will remind people, NSF people who are participating for the NSF, there will be that Professor Vickerson will have an office hour from 3 to 4. All of you should have invitations in your calendars. You can join the Zoom and continue the conversation. But in the meantime, again, thank you so much for a fascinating talk. With that, we'll let you go have a little bit of a rest and some sustenance. So thank you again.
Thanks. Thank you very much.